From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, it is our latest Across the Divide conversation in collaboration with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. From Me Too to What Now looks at what the Me Too movement is accomplishing for sexual harassment victims at all levels of society.
The Me Too movement is really about raising awareness for people who weren't aware of really the epidemic proportions of the issues that we're dealing with. You need to raise awareness first, though, to catch everyone up before you can then change the trajectory of where we're at with this issue.
Plus, we'll explore how the conversation can incorporate people of all social strata, including those who may not have a platform to fight back. And we'll ask whether all victims need to speak up.
Survivors know what they got to do. And whatever they did to get through whatever they got through was the right thing that they had to do. End of sentence.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North. The Me Too movement has been top of mind for around 6 months, even if the issues of sexual harassment it addresses have been around for generations. From the allegations against powerful celebrities such as Harvey Weinstein, Garrison Keillor, and Roy Moore, to the conviction of the USA Gymnastics team doctor, sexual misconduct is being talked about in a way that it generally hasn't been, out in the open. The latest conversation in our Across the Divide collaboration with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel focused on these issues. From Me Too to What Now was recorded in front of an audience at Good City Brewing in Milwaukee. It featured a four-person panel, Lena Huarbe, Director of Community Engagement for the group A Call to Men, employment lawyer Nola Hitchcock-Cross, artist and Black Paint Studios co-owner Katie Mullen, and attorney, consultant, and life coach Rhonda Ware. The moderators were Journal Sentinel reporter Mary Spicuzza and Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke. The evening opened with reflections from each of the panelists about how the national dialogue should evolve from here, starting with Lena Huarbe.
You know, I'm here because Me Too, and I mean Me Too at the end of the day, and because I don't want my children to be me also. And from my perspective at A Call to Men, what we're seeking really is to engage men in these conversations. We oftentimes say that if we could have solved these issues, we would have done it decades ago. And I'm seeking, you know, connection to men. I want to hold men accountable, for sure. But I want to do that in spite of the fact that most violence in my life was at the hands of men. I want to be in the dichotomy that both things are true, that I want to hold them accountable, but I also want to have hope and healing from them, for them. And I want to invite them into that conversation. And so that's kind of the hat that I'm wearing today.
Thank you so much. Now let's meet Nola Hitchcock-Cross.
Thank you for all coming out. This is so exciting to have such a great group of people. And I think in terms of, I don't know about takeaway, we'll see what the takeaway is as we get going a little bit more. But in my work, because I usually work in the legal arena, what we have to fight is that concept of he said, she said, and I can never prove it, and I can't come forward, and I can't really do anything, and I can't really say anything. And so the takeaway that I'm really looking for is that we all see that those innocuous little teeny tiny things that don't seem like a big deal, those are the ones that give everybody permission to do everything else. And so we all need to kind of stand up and call things out. And I'm hoping that we all kind of look at that. And in my work, I see, frankly, a lot of times the men are the best witnesses, and that sometimes they do stand up and call things out more than some women do. And so I really want women to embrace that and men to feel that they're part of this conversation.
Thank you so much. Katie Mullen is our next panelist this evening.
I'm Katie Mullen. I am co-owner of Black Paint Studios, which is an art and design company here in Milwaukee, and I also founded an all-women arts collective that focuses on community activism, specifically centered around gender issues affecting women and girls. And the reason, the sole reason actually, that I started Black Paint Studios with my partner Jordan, who is sitting over there, was because the two of us had had it with the art and design industry in a way I think people have had it with culture, with this culture in general. Mm-hmm. Right now, that's what we're talking about. We found it to be very misogynistic. There were condoned cultures of misogyny, really, and there was a lot of harassment in our industry. In particular, the two of us are creatives. We wanted to be creative leaders in our industry, but we saw no examples of creative. There are plenty of women who work in advertising, but there are very few who make it to the creative leadership level, and so we quit. We quit our jobs in those agencies, and we decided it was on us to do something about that. And so now we go around and talk about it in public, to specifically do a lot of students talk about these issues. And I guess one thing that I hope to get out of today, I don't have all the answers. I don't know if I even have any answers, but I'm just excited to talk to these brilliant women sitting on the stage and hear from all of you.
And finally, Rhonda Ware.
Good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here with you. My name is Rhonda Ware. I am the founder and president of my company, You Are Aware LLC. And it was really birthed out of a need to support mostly women, but some men as well, in really living their life, a life of purpose on purpose. In addition, though, for longer than I can remember, so it's been about 20 years, I've been a consultant and national trainer for an organization called the Mentors in Violence Prevention Program. And this organization is really a wonderful organization because men and women are working together to identify, prevent, and confront sexist abuse and men's violence against women. What do I hope we get today? I hope each and every one of you leave hearing one thing that you can do to push this issue forward and take action to make positive change.
We're going to be turning to audience questions really quickly. Before we do, though, I wanted to hear from the panelists. Basically, if you could just tell us a little bit about your thoughts on the Me Too movement, especially where do we go from here? And Nola, would you like to start?
Sure. It's interesting. I was reading, just came back on the airplane from New Orleans, and I was doing a lot of reading on the airplane while we were delayed. And there's an article from a journalist from France who started the French kind of Me Too movement, Out Your Pig, I guess it was called, in French. And the person that she actually outed has now sued her for damages for defamation. And he admitted everything he said, word for word, everything was admitted. He said, this is not sexual harassment. And that also comes from the Catherine Devenue kind of approach to, you know, this is flirting, it's not sexual harassment. So that's, you know, kind of a divide I think a lot of people talk about. And we have certainly had that around our holiday table with three sons and a daughter that I have in terms of this, you know, this kind of conversation. So I guess that's an issue that I think a lot is in a lot of people's mind, both women and men, in terms of where's the line, you know, what you don't want to feel like you can't approach people, but at the same time, you know, the real answer is power. When, you know, when there's power involved, that's where the line is.
Sure. I have so many thoughts about, you know, Me Too. First of all, I'll say it's an invitation. We can no longer say that we don't know. None of us, after all that we have heard, we would need to believe that women are conspiring with each other to come up with very similar stories. It reminds me actually of, you know, sexual assault in the Catholic Church and what happened actually in Milwaukee about 10 years ago. We would have to believe that everybody's talking to each other and conspiring to tell the same truths. What it means for us as a community is that we can't act like it's not happening. And my invitation to you is that to realize that we all have a role to play. And specifically as the work of A Call to Men, it's really, you know, the few men who are here, I want to say to you, you know, you're silent or you participating in any of the jokes that we all know what I'm talking about, the jokes that are inappropriate, or when you were telling me today that an adult man talked to a group of adult women as, hey, girls, come and help me over here. All those pieces, we have to raise our awareness about that. Because sexual harassment
is in the family of sexual violence and sexual assault. We have to have the same foundation for it to happen. And we all have to ask ourselves, how is it that we have such a fertile foundation for it to happen? Actually, quite frankly, without much discomfort. Without much discomfort. And oftentimes, when a survivor has said, well, you know, I didn't like that, or, verbally says, that's not okay with me, it continues to be flipped with the misogyny that you were talking about, right? So what role, my question to you is, what role are you willing to play? And we all have points of access and points to have some privilege or influence, as we would say at A Call to Men. You have an influence, you have a possibility of your platform, whether it's at church, with children you go, in all your circles, what are you gonna do? What are you gonna do? We are here to invite men into this conversation, not to indict them. We have a responsibility to talk about socialization. We are all children of the same socialization. Even as women, I've been taught the same things about women. Do you know what I'm trying to say, right?
Yes.
And so we have to be dismantling that. We have to have these type of critical conversations with each other. And to me, that's the invitation that we have at hand. And what are we willing to risk? And lastly, I would say about the Me Too movement. I think it's really important for us to also understand intersectionality when we talk about this. You know, the Me Too movement was developed about 11 years ago by a black woman. And it didn't get any traction. And you know what? I love Ashley Judd. She actually is a huge supporter of A Call to Men. And I love her. But it wasn't until white women started talking about this that it got traction. So I want you to just sit with that. What does that mean? What does that tell us? It means to me as a woman of color that those that reside at the margins, and even more so, the margins of the margins, are invisible. And you know, all my white ally women who are in this room, your victimization, your survival, I don't want my healing without yours. But I want you to use your power and access to fight for those people at the margins. You can't act like you don't know that.
Can I jump in and either follow up with you or slightly redirect the question to the two of you? What does change look like aside from changing attitudes? You know, the Me Too cases that are so famous get a lot of headlines, but one imagines that the next step is going to be something that's going to get fewer headlines. How does it happen? What does the change look like beyond just a shift in approach?
But I think that's what the change is the change in attitude and the change in the shift in approach.
But how do you hold someone's feet to the fire and make them change their attitude?
I think Lena really has it spot on. And we heard last week that disabled people are sexually harassed 7 times more frequently than non-disabled people. And talk about people of color, how about those who are undocumented? They're just completely at the mercy, and the level of harassment there is exponentially more than white women. And when you're talking about white women, you're not just talking about that. You're talking about beautiful Hollywood white women who actually brought this to the fore, and that makes a difference. But it's the attitude that makes a difference, and that's why I was telling her, I was coming back on this airplane, and there were these three women, maybe about 60 years old. And the guy was like, hey, girls. And, I said, and they were like really upset. And they were the flight
crew.
And they said, they just were taken aback. They were kind of speechless. And then they said, okay, guy, And I said, well, actually the parallel is boy. And then, but they were all black. And they just really had trouble uttering that word for, obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. And and then he said, oh, I love being called boy. That's so, like I'm older and that's like really cool. And I said, but you know what? They don't, so don't do it. And it really, I just think if we all just kind of, it's just every day, it happens 1,000 times every day when you see it. It's a little tiny thing, it's not a big deal. You don't really want to offend anybody and you're in the line, just speak up. It's that little tiny attitude that really does make a difference. And when you say, well, what's the big change other than attitude? It's attitude that makes the difference. And it's the willingness to actually speak up and call a little tiny thing that makes people who have bigger issues, more egregious harassment and sexual assault, feel that they are empowered enough to actually come forward.
If I could just add a few points. So I really appreciate everything the panelists have said and stand in agreement. The Me Too movement is really about raising awareness for people who weren't aware of really the epidemic proportions of the issues that we're dealing with. You need to raise awareness first, though, to catch everyone up before you can then change the trajectory of where we're at with this issue. So what we can all do, right, is we can raise awareness in our own peer groups, in our homes, and in the workplace. After you're doing that, you want to create an environment where you're able to have an open dialogue similar to what we're doing, where we can talk about these issues. That does mean you have to provide a safe space for people to talk about these issues, because although a lot of us have done this work for decades, there are people who don't know what sexual harassment is. They don't know what consent is. So you want to catch people up to open a dialogue, but then you have to challenge some thinking. You have to challenge thinking and then inspire leadership and action. And that's where you're really making decisions on the job, where you are creating equity, where you are creating opportunities, where you are promoting women. And you need both men and women to do those things. But I think you really do have to start at raising awareness. And I think that's a benefit to Me Too. And I just would like to actually say one thing. For someone who's done the work for years, what Me Too did for me, I mean, one in six women will be the victim of either sexual assault or attempted sexual assault in her lifetime. But when I saw Me Too, I'm reminded of, I mean, there are people all around the country and all around the world. And so it's giving voice to victims who aren't coming forward. We can use that as an opportunity to fuel change. But we should be inclusive in that and not assume that everyone really knew this issue was as pervasive as it is.
That's attorney and executive coach Rhonda Ware speaking at our Across the Divide conversation on the Me Too movement. We'll have more of the conversation when Lake Effect returns here on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. Today's show is a broadcast of our recent Across the Divide conversation presented with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It's called From Me Too to What Now, and our guests are employment attorney Nola Hitchcock Cross, artist and studio owner Katie Mullen, consultant and life coach Rhonda Ware, and Lena Warbe, director of community engagement for the group A Call to Men. It's moderated by Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke and the Journal Sentinel's Mary Spacuzza. As we continue our conversation, Katie Mullen talks about how the movement can incorporate people who are not connected with celebrities, those people whose jobs are out of the spotlight.
Yeah, absolutely. Like my Me Too story. I actually talked to a reporter in Milwaukee about my Me Too story last week, but it's definitely not a headline story here. And like, you know, I'm sure a lot of ours will never be headline stories either. So I get what you're saying. It's such a hard question, and I think that leadership and HR at regular companies, like small, mid, large-sized companies that all of us have probably worked for, need to be ready for this coming to their front doorstep. Maybe it's not going to be a news headline, but maybe it's going to be women who are finally feel emboldened because they know they're not alone now, stepping up and filing a complaint. And what happens when you file a complaint? Well, what happened when I filed a complaint was worse than the sexual assault itself, actually, in my opinion. It made me feel so small. It made me feel crazy, actually, practically, the response that I got from HR. And so there, I just don't think that women are going to accept that as a response anymore. And two, then there's the Time's Up political or legal fund that they've started, too, specifically for women who are not rich in Hollywood and can make headlines with their story. But so you have potentially a support system and some legal recourse if you're handled, if you take that to HR and they handle it like it was handled with me. So I mean, those things are growing. I don't know today the answer. That may not happen today. You still may tomorrow get a response like I did at HR, but I think the time is coming. And like I said, it's going to be on the front door of the executives of those companies and on the front door of HR departments, and they better think about how they're going to handle it a lot different than they have in the past.
Well, and I don't want you to feel like you have to share something you don't want to, but can you talk a little bit about what the response was from HR? I mean, because just the way you're describing it, I imagine a lot of people might have had similar experiences.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So a couple of years ago, and I actually did an art activism piece about it afterwards, because that's what I do with those experiences. So there's a poster about this somewhere that I wheat pasted called, "Do You Want an Exciting Career in Advertising?" So I work in advertising. I worked for agencies the second half of my career, and I went on a job interview at one of these agencies where I did not end up working. And during the job interview, the man who was interviewing me, this was the second interview, and he asked if he could take me to lunch across the street for the interview, which is totally not unusual when you're at that stage for the type of job that I was applying for. So I went to lunch with him across the street at the second interview, and from the very beginning to the very end, it was comments about how I looked, telling me how much he hates his wife, and that if he hired me, that he would want to go out to drinks every night with me. And then he, this is my favorite part, was the end, where he asked if he could order ice cream so he could watch me eat it. And that was when it was, like, finally, right, yeah.
Undeniable.
Right, completely undeniable. Mm-hmm. And this was still before I was woke or whatever. You know, like, I'm fairly ashamed of, like, what I did. I mean, immediately I called HR on my way home, right? I got up and left and was, like, made it clear I was offended during that moment. But if it was me right now, I would have made a scene. Like, it doesn't feel comfortable or natural for me to make a scene. I'm not a scene-making kind of person, but I should have made a scene and made him feel as uncomfortable as he was making me. And we did this in a public place where I felt like I couldn't, like, stand up and, like, point in his face or throw something at him. And I totally would do that. That's actually exactly what I would do today. So then back to HR, right? I called this woman who had set up the interview in HR, and I told her the entire experience. And she didn't respond to me at all. I left her a voicemail, so I didn't talk to her directly. It was complete silence, nothing, which made me feel like either she thought I was nuts, didn't believe me, or just didn't think that this was a big deal, right? None of those are good responses. You're gonna, like, okay, this, and the better part, or the worst part, I should say, is a year later, she called me, the same woman, the same HR person, asking if I would come interview for a position at this same company. And I called her back, and she wasn't available again, and I left her another voicemail, and I said, "I don't know if you remember when I left you this voicemail message about how terrible my experience was when I was on this interview, and you never called me back. I would never, ever in my life consider working for this company. Please don't call me again." She called me a year and a half later, again. She didn't respond to it either. She got a second voicemail to me, and she never called back, like, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry this happened to you. I'm so sorry I never responded. Something happened." There was nothing again. And then finally we had it out on the third time. We had a full-on blowout the third time that this happened. And I don't know if it was sincere or not. I don't believe it was sincere. I believe it was only sincere because I sort of made a threat towards the end of it, and that was about it. But, like, I'm like, this is why this continues, why this cycle continues in our industry, and this is why women don't report.
We need to be training people in leadership. We need to be training HR. We need to be training team leaders. We need to be training university professionals. You have to actually train them what to do. So one strategy, technique that the Mentors in Violence program uses is social scenarios. So, you know, you're walking down the hall and let's say a coworker comments on your legs or your short skirt. What do you do? And you're talking about what do bystanders do as well. And then what should HR be doing as a response? It's almost, I'm sure we have some Packers fans in the audience. You know, they have training camp before the season. So when they get in the game, they know how to handle something. And sometimes people need real tools. So as we talk about what can we really do, and it's not about Hollywood, it's about, you know, this where we're at now. It's about wherever you are, demand that there's some training and some real tools, because we know statistically this is happening. So then what can we do to address it?
Well, and to your point, we have to practice it.
We have to.
I always joke, like, we don't talk about power, money, racism, sex, right? These are things that we don't openly talk about. So we have to practice how to have these conversations. And corporations and organizations have to move beyond. We really appreciate protocol and procedures and guidelines. That's really important. But we also have to be looking at our culture of the organization, like the organization you talked about, for him to have done that with such level of comfort in a second interview. Mm-hmm. For you to have told somebody, like, if you would have called me, I would have been like, "Oh my God,
Let me get on this immediately. And I'm so sorry this happened, right? How did that happen? We have to ask ourselves for 3 years with dead silence and comfortability, right? So how do we bring forward, how do we practice, how do we have these conversations? You know, we should have this conversation with 100 men, with men sitting here, and talking about how do we do this? How do we learn how to talk to each other? How do we over-communicate during any sexual interaction? You know, sex should be wonderful before, during, and after. And if at any point you're like, we should all be talking about that. And so we should be talking about that before. We have to learn how do we say that. So what's okay with you? What's not okay with you? We do a lot of training with the NFL. And we train every team. And we're talking about these exact same things that we're talking about that. But we got to practice that. We're not raised with that. And we're dying for other men to engage other men, to pour into the souls of young boys around this issue. It is a desperate, we have a desperate issue of fatherlessness. And I'm connecting the dots, you guys. All this is all connected to what we're talking about. Oftentimes we try to look at one issue. People don't come in one issue. I've never worked with a survivor who said to me, my only issue was that I was raped yesterday. It doesn't happen that way. And one of the things that we do is we cut people's experience. We cut people's experience. So we have to learn to be with each other, have more communication. How do we talk about this with each other?
But before we have another question, I really have to go to HR because I deal in that world. And I get a call every single day. I went to HR, I complain, and then I was fired. They said I was tardy. They said I missed a deadline. And you know what? So did everybody else. How many times a day do I say HR is not your friend? HR's purpose is to protect the company from liability. The problem is, as Rhonda explains, is that the way they really accomplish that is to be trained and to kind of embrace the person who is coming to them with an issue. But there are so many HR departments where the opposite is the case, and the experience is more like Katie had, where the HR, you would complain, and HR's response is hostile, or nothing, or retaliation. And so we always have to say HR is not your friend. And the most effective HR is when they do embrace the person who is making the complaint, because you know what? That's what makes the company better. You know what? That's what increases morale. And you know what? That's what increases the bottom line.
Yeah, silence and enabling do not help a company, and they don't make it stronger, and they don't solve the problem. And I had a similar experience with a previous newspaper HR where it was...
Previous?
Yes, not my current newspaper.
Can I just jump back in, though, and ask, I guess, is it already too late for the people who have risen to a certain level at HR and still have these attitudes? Does the change have to come in the people who are going to be next?
Never too late, but I think this is a Rhonda question.
Well, no, I would agree. It's not. I don't think it's ever too late. But it really is about people's commitment to change, and being educated and being trained, and then actually moving forward. And you have to, I guess, demand the change on the other side of that. But I don't think it's ever too late. And again, people have been doing this work for years and years and years and years and years. There's always an opportunity, though, I believe.
I also would add that, you know, I would say I agree with you, Rhonda, it's never too late. Mm-hmm. I also think that we have to continue again to, how do we create an environment? How do we pull at the root of the foundation for that to happen? So he openly called people girls, and, you know, that's probably the most subtle thing I want to say in the room. You all know the other things that happen, right? And that happens without discomfort, and we have to go back to that. So how do we, in organizations, in corporations, go beyond the HR procedure piece and talk about organizational culture, corporate culture? What do we appreciate culturally? How do we invest in our own community? How do we have these conversations? How do we prioritize the training? But I would say it has to be more like transformational authenticity communication training. It's not about this is what you do and this is what you don't do. If that's what we continue to do, we'll end up in the same place. We're going to end up in the same place. So it has to go deeper. We have to go from snorkeling to deep diving, right? We have to.
But to piggyback off on that question, it's not too late for people who have been doing, been in these positions and in positions of power to be trained, but also we have to start with our young people and educating them on how to treat girls, how to treat boys. I'm talking about when they're little, you know, when they're 4, 5, 6, respecting people. We need to be addressing this problem again on every level because we're all socialized in the mm-hmm. same space, mm-hmm. which is what Lena talked about. So wherever you're at, I hope the message is, what can you do? And to go back to what Katie was saying about the person in HR who really became a bystander in this situation, who didn't do anything and then actually was detrimental to Katie's experience. I mean, what are we doing as bystanders? What are we doing when we're getting that call? What are we doing when somebody's reporting something to us? Are we believing them? Are we asking more questions? Are we providing them with resources? Mm-hmm. We can all do something right where we're at. And we have to in order to see a significant change that'll be lasting and impact generations behind us.
It's about seeking humanity, seeing a human being in front of you. Absolutely. And not treating someone like a number. To your point around going to young people, one of the things that we've done at A Call to Men is develop this curriculum called Live Respect. And last year we interviewed about 300 young boys. And even I was floored by the result of the things we found out. 81% of the young boys, middle school, high school students, said they didn't even know what consent was. The vast majority of them said that they didn't think it was okay for a girl to say, I don't want to have sex with you, midway. So using that type of work, we have to go young. We also connected to the fatherless issue. We need to have other men. We need young boys to see other men doing the right thing. I need you to model. I can't fix this. I can't make the world safer for my kids.
Also in HR, we have to make it about the bottom line. And as Katie explained like fantastically well, she's talking about her experience, but look at the company. They lost out on a fantastic client that they tried to recruit 3 times. You know, why? You know, because of HR's inaction. And so HR was doing the opposite of what it was supposed to do because of poor training, but also just to understand that it affects the bottom line, that, you know, half the good candidates are female and you're not going to get them if you don't take care of business within the culture that you have. It's bad for business. And that's what HR, that's what resonates with HR. It's bad for business.
At the core of all this, too, is a lack of value that we have in the experience of women. Like, oh, girl, that happened to me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure that woman probably has had another call. I'm sure that was not the first time he's ever done that.
Yeah.
We all know that.
Absolutely not.
His comfort indicates that he's done that before without any consequence happening. Mm-hmm. So we have to recognize that, again, we're all children of the same socialization. But particularly men get messages on a regular basis to see women as objects, possessions, and to be not invested in their experience as human beings. And we have to address that at the same time that we're addressing all these other issues that we're talking about.
That's Lena Warbe with the organization A Call to Men, speaking at our Across the Divide event, From Me Too to What Now. We'll have the conclusion of that conversation in just a moment on Lake Effect here on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. WUWM and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel presented the latest edition of our series Across the Divide last week, called From Me Too to What Now. Our guests included artist and Black Paint Studios owner Katie Mullen, attorney and life coach Rhonda Ware, Lena Warbe of A Call to Men, and employment attorney Nola Hitchcock Cross. It was recorded in front of an audience at Good City Brewing in Milwaukee, and it was moderated by the Journal Sentinel's Mary Spicuzza and Lake Effect's Mitch Teich. The conversation continues now with a question from an audience member who asked if the panelists could reconcile the societal imperative to say something about sexual harassment with the instincts of victims to follow their survival instincts to walk away in an effort to keep the situation from becoming worse. Here's Lena Warbe.
Survivors know what they got to do. And whatever they did to get through whatever they got through was the right thing that they had to do. End of sentence. That's it. Whatever it was. It's always easier to say shoulda, coulda, woulda. It's really hard when it's a family member or a friend. You know, I have an advocate hat, and then I have my Lena hat, right? So I try to merge them because survivors, whether they're a family member of mine or they're just my neighbor or someone that I don't know or just met, they want to hear the same thing. Whatever you did, and it is the truth. It is the truth. Survivors have this holographic 360 multicolor thing that happens all at once when they need to survive what they need to get through. And for some women, that might be, I just was talking to a woman who said, I just let him do what he had to do. Do you understand what I'm saying, right? I just let him do what he had to do. I wanted to live in one piece. And you know what? You did what you had to do. And none of us have a right to go to the shoulda, coulda, woulda. None of us. And for the men, you know, one of the things I want to say around the previous question, you know, when there's like, no one says, no, I don't want to have sex with you. If that doesn't happen, we have to move to consent. You have to get a verbal consent. You have to like look at someone. You have to look at what they're saying and what they're not saying and the nonverbals. When someone says no or maybe, it doesn't mean for you to try harder. It doesn't mean for you to persist and insist and sexually coerce. It means stop unless you have an affirmation, unequivocal, undeniable affirmation.
It was interesting when the Me Too movement started, it's something else I thought of, just kind of watching the coverage. I thought, well, what about the women and men who don't want to do hashtag Me Too? And I even felt like that, like, how do I feel about that? Or, you know, surveys that make you respond to every single question, and maybe you don't want to about it because you're still processing and working through what you've been through. So certainly, and none of us mean to imply that you have to do something or say something, but I think it's great. You know, I wish the 20-some-year-old Rhonda had the information that I have now, because I would have known there were other things that I could have done. So maybe it still wasn't confronting, you know, the person I worked for, but maybe it was going to a healing center to talk to someone to make sure I was okay and knew it wasn't my fault, or you know what I mean? So there's other things to do. So please, it's not your fault.
And I want to just address confidentiality clauses, because I think we've been talking a little bit about, you know, stepping forward and doing something and going to HR and, you know, all of those kinds of things. And, you know, yes, there are a lot of cases that go to federal court and sexual harassment, and there's a place for that and there's a time for that. And there's the situations where that's makes sense for the people, the woman who's involved in bringing it forward. But there's also a place for situations where things are very confidential and things are handled in a completely different way, and that where things never see the light of day. The first time, as when you say like a 20-something lawyer, if I knew what, the first time when I started doing sexual harassment cases in employment, and I was asked to put a confidentiality clause in the settlement, I just was like, just, it was just abhorrent to me. It was so disgusting. I couldn't even imagine. I mean, the point is like, this happened and we don't want it to happen again, and we want people to know about it and all of that. And the EEOC takes the position that they are inappropriate. However, that I think prohibiting confidentiality clauses, and there's some movement toward that in some context at this moment, it's just very complicated, because I think that it would mean that a lot of people would not come forward at all if they knew that they would be outed in terms of their workplace and their boss and the whole situation. And I would definitely say to the, you know, 20-year-old self where confidentiality clauses were abhorrent, that the vast majority of the cases that I do don't see the light of day at all. They don't necessarily even see anything in writing. You know, with cases with judges and court clerks and, you know, things that you know, if they do become public, it's a huge thing. And the victim becomes more victimized sometimes because of the publicity situation. So would I rather everything is, you know, non-confidential and out there? Sure, that has a lot of value, but it also has a lot of negatives, meaning a lot of women would just not come forward, and things wouldn't get righted, and the perpetrators also, you know, there's consequences even with settlements where there's confidentiality clauses. So I would just encourage women to know that, you know, if you want to kind of get into the legal process, it's not an all or nothing thing at all. I mean, it's not like federal court or nothing. It's like most cases, pick up the phone, things get resolved, and things are confidential. And whether that's right or wrong depends on what the victim wants and what's going to make sense to the victim and what's going to help the victim move forward in that career or in another career, and to not necessarily have it get in the public eye.
What do you think the media has gotten wrong about this story as it's evolved over the last 6 months?
Using the word accuser? You don't do that when somebody steals your purse. So let's sit with that. What does that mean? What are we saying? Right? Using the word accuser.
Anyone else?
I think focusing on and picking apart and doing think pieces about the witch hunt. I completely reject the idea of this being a witch hunt. And obviously that's being used as a tactic, like a very smart tactic, unfortunately, to try to silence more people who may want to come forward, that now you're just part of this hysterical, I think, what did I call it before, rampaging mob, you all of you feminists. Yeah, if we could not call it a witch hunt anymore, that'd be great.
And let's sit down and be analytical for a minute. What do you get? If I were to say that a prominent person sexually assaulted me or sexually harassed me today, really, let's just sit down and think about what I gain. I know we want to believe that a lot of people lie. I'm not saying that people don't lie. I am not saying that. But what do I gain?
I guess I would like to see, I don't know, more information about just how pervasive the issue is instead of just making it about Harvey Weinstein or Matt Lauer or Bill Cosby, but just use it as an opportunity to say this is just a small part of what's happening every day. And then I'd also like to see having more of the uncomfortable conversations, and I know there's probably only so much you can do, but talk about how our boys and girls are socialized. And you know, that very same you know, boy who might be being abusive in school is the one who then might be a hiring partner and not paying, you know, women what they should be due. So yeah, just the complexity of it. I think I found the media oversimplifying or just making about one person as opposed to making about a much bigger issue that touches everyone in this room.
I would just really like it if the phrase "he said, she said" never was uttered by anyone ever again.
Yeah.
Because first of all, it's just not true. I mean, because if we do speak up for the little things, you kind of get the pattern of the perpetrator, and you kind of there's more to the context than "he said, she said." But also, it's almost never happens if you get the list of all the women who have worked for that person before that, and who all left, that it didn't happen before. And it's not "he said, she said." It's "she said, she said, she said, she said." And he's being listened to.
And when in doubt, compare it to another crime. If I called the police today and my four tires of my car were removed, and when they showed up, the tires were in there, they'll be like, "Are you sure you had tires before you came? Are you sure? Are you certain?" Let's compare it to other pieces, because it goes back to what you talked about, Katie, misogyny, not believing women, not valuing women, right? So let's make those connections. If you said somebody stole my purse, then we're like, "Well, show me a video that you had a purse 10 minutes ago," right? Let's really, really be in that space of that type of critical thinking.
We got one question about retaliation, which I think is a big issue. It says, "Retaliation is why women do not fight back. Retaliation is very severe, can destroy careers." Just having a little trouble reading it. "Livelihoods. Men have power, money, prestige, and that, you know, women can be destroyed when they come forward."
No question about it. I mean,
that's just a fact. That's a fact.
That's a fact, and that's the deterrent. On the other hand, and that's the reason really to speak up and to kind of document stuff. I mean, if something happens, you tell it, you know, like, what did Comey do? He told everybody around, you know, he told the people around him, so they've got that record. You tell people around you. You go home and you tell people. You tell people who are your coworkers. You tell other people so that there's, you know, some record of the situation. And you know, people understand when there's retaliation. So, you know, if that person is then fired for coming in late, you know, speak up. You know, you came in late, but you weren't a victim and nothing happened to you when you came in late, and it's not fair. And you know what? It, you know, everyone knows that. And going back to the bottom line and, you know, why that's bad for business is, you know, it's so bad for morale when you see somebody complains and then they're terminated and everyone knows why they're terminated. You know, the coworkers leave and they don't come back as Katie did. They don't come back. So I think it's the kind of the speaking up and letting the company know in the employment context that it's not okay.
I think it's important for us to recognize again the complexity, right? Because my first instinct is I want to say to everybody, tell. I tell my own kids, you tell your teacher, you tell somebody else. When someone doesn't listen or doesn't react like the person that you worked with, you tell somebody else, right? But that's overly simplistic. I would like to create a world that would be valid and possible, really possible for all of us, that we would tell, we would be believed, I would support you, and we would be in this together. I just don't think it happens like that a lot of the time. We also have to acknowledge the reality. It is a huge risk to tell. So for any of you and to my younger self and my ongoing growing self, do what you got to do to survive what you got to survive. I'm telling you right now, it's unjust, it should not be happening. But it would be oversimplistic for me to say, tell. Let me tell you, if you're a black woman, we have to think about intersectionality, right? If you're a person that is living in the margins, and you have all these other pieces that are happening, if you're undocumented, and you have 3 kids. So as advocates who, to me, are the answer to everything, and community organizers, you follow the lead of the person that's going through what they're going through. And you offer options. You open different doors. And that's, to me, you know, the hope that we can have right now. It's not a simplistic answer. So both things can be true at the same time. I want you to tell, and then, but you need to walk in your shoes every day. I don't.
But that's when you come to the responsibility of the bystanders. Is, you know, you don't leave the burden on the victim, because mm-hmm. the victim has enough to worry about. You know, the burden really should be on the bystanders and on the, you know, in the employment context, and the coworkers and the people who have understand this kind of experience and know what happened. And you know, we have many situations where it's not the victim who's the one who complains. It's not the victim who's the one who complains. And normally, you know, if somebody else complains who's not the victim, they're not going to be retaliated against nearly to the, you know, it's much less likely than if the victim complains himself. So, you know, go forward for somebody else.
Well, and the retaliation piece is interesting. So just thinking, if I wasn't aware, well, let's say I'm working somewhere, something happens, I am afraid to say anything because I believe I will be retaliated against. What would be helpful for someone like me is an education program about what my options would be. So let's say I do report mm-hmm. and I am retaliated against, then I can contact, you know, NOLA's office, or there are other things that I can do in order to address that. If I had that information beforehand, then I would know what to do once I was in that situation. And that's why education is so important, because a lot of times we're walking around thinking a particular thing and there can be potential risk, but a mm-hmm, lot of it is mm-hmm. you just don't know what to do. So I just encourage you all, again, where you sit, bring in education programs in order to really empower people to make informed decisions about their own life and how they should handle their
and
situation.
That's so brilliant, because if you're going to have a confidentiality clause, you can also have a mandatory training clause. And that is the piece that, you know, a lot of times there's affirmative pieces in a settlement where nobody may know about it, but there's going to be some mandatory training. Nobody knows why, but there's going to be mandatory training to make sure that it's less likely that it happens to somebody else.
Do you have any optimism, the four of you, that the fact that these conversations are happening now bodes well for the generation that is coming of age? Are younger people, as they move into the employment world, going to be coming into it with different expectations than previous generations?
Absolutely. From my perspective in working with young people, yes. I think that this is, like, what's happening right now is no less than a worldwide revolution, cultural revolution, or the start of one, anyways. I know it's not that easy to undo since the beginning of time problem, right? I'm not naive. But I also don't think that now that our eyes are open that we can unsee what we've all seen collectively. Mm-hmm. I think that this moment of collective consciousness, it won't turn backwards. I mean, there'll definitely be things, there will be forces that try, like witch hunt and all those kinds of things, that try to shut it down, but I think that that's almost impossible at this point.
Let's do this again next year and see how much.
So I do think expectations have changed, but outcomes have to change or else we'll be in the same place that we are at. So we must move past the hashtag to real action. And again, you know, I'm 45, so people who are, you know, older, we've had these kinds of conversations before that we haven't had kind of the hashtags, but we've had different kinds of conversations. Women are still making, you know, 72% to 76% of that. So we have to turn this into outcomes. And that's going to take each and every one of us to continue to be committed to this issue beyond this conversation.
You've been listening to an excerpted version of our Across the Divide event, From Me Too to What Now?, presented in collaboration with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Our panel included Rhonda Ware, Lena Huarbe, Katie Mullen, and Nola Hitchcock Cross. It was moderated by the Journal Sentinel's Mary Spacuzza and Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke. It was recorded in front of an audience at Good City Brewing in Milwaukee, and our field engineer was Jason Reavy. You can hear the interview in its entirety at a link at WUWM.com, and we'll continue our look at the Me Too movement tomorrow, when Milwaukee PBS hosts Joanne Williams and Elizabeth Baker from the Neighborhood News Service join us to talk about their series on sexual harassment in Milwaukee. I'm Bonnie Noor. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.